All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Searching for Grog. It has been quite a while since we have put anything together, and we haven't been sitting on our haunches exactly. We have been sort of picking away at this mystery, but it has been a grueling thing. I may have mentioned this to you guys before, but it really is like, it's kind of like the challenge of achieving the speed of light. Like, it's a logarithmic difficulty scale. So like that point of getting from 99 to 100 takes like twice as much energy as 1 to 99. You know, it's like, we got so close, and then actually identifying the person at this point is almost impossible, just because it requires somebody who not only was there, but remembers clearly 35 years ago, you know. And I was trying to remember like the names. I just gave myself this same challenge because I was thinking, okay, when I used to work at Hudson back in 2006, so that's what, 15, 16 or 17 years ago. And so I was trying to remember the names of everybody I worked with, and I couldn't, like, you know, and that's half the distance to what, or I mean, half the time that we're talking about with a lot of these people. So it is going to be really hard to get this last 1% of the, you know, of the mystery done. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So let me introduce our other hosts. We have all the way from Oakland, California, Andrew Passion, a.k.a. Grog.
What up, dudes?
And all the way from, I think you're in San Jose. Yeah, South San Jose, California. We have Evan Passion, a.k.a. Pi.
What's up, everybody?
I don't think we've ever called you Pi on the mic, so maybe people don't know.
No.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Pi, so. Okay.
What's the origin there? Is it obvious?
I don't think there is one. I think it's just literally us calling him Evie Pi, like a little cutie pie.
Okay.
And then we started writing it as the symbol pi, but I don't think there's anything.
Yeah, there was no long history to that.
Yeah, we've covered it now.
It's because he's so irrational.
Ba-dum-tsh. Hey.
So anyway, guys, before we jump into the meat and potatoes here, which is not a slang for madoic, we are going to. I wanted to ask you guys something really quickly. So I was at a dinner the other day with this customer, and they have like a guy who just joined the company, right? And so they asked me, "Oh, how long have you been in Japan?" And so I said, "Oh, I moved here in 2007. And this new kid who had just joined the company was like, "Oh, I was still in elementary school then." And I was like, "Oh," made me feel really old. And so I asked him the same thing I ask everybody, which is my way of gauging, like, to put it in more simple terms, like, for how old somebody is. I asked him, what was the first, you know, video game console that you played on, especially what was the first Nintendo console that you played on? And for him, it was Wii. That was the first thing he remembers.
Oh, gross.
Wow.
Playing, which made me feel even older.
Yeah, that's brutal.
So, I was curious about, like, for you guys, I mean, especially you, Norton, you're, you know, quite a bit younger than us, and Evan, I think we're not that different in age, but like, what for you, like, when you hear Nintendo, like, and you conjure up an image in your mind, what is the actual machine, like the hardware that you envision when you hear that word Nintendo? Evan, why don't you answer that first?
Yeah, it's actually funny you mentioned that, and funny you mentioned feeling old, because as you know, I teach at a high school, so the kids in my class were like born in 2007. So we'll be doing you know, AP problems from, you know, years that they weren't even born in yet. So when I was a kid, we had an original Nintendo. But I actually, when I think of it, the one I remember most fondly and that I kind of remember playing a lot of different games on was the Super Nintendo. When I think of like the original NES, I remember playing, you know, the original Mario Brothers. We had like the Mario Brothers Duck Hunt combo that like everybody had. And maybe a couple other games, but I was just pretty young and didn't play with it all that much. And then as I was kind of really getting into video games, that's when we got the Super Nintendo. And that was the one I remember like really wanting and asking for Christmas and being so excited when I got it. And even when I think of playing like those original Mario NES games, I remember getting the Super Mario All-Stars cartridge for Super Nintendo. Good. And that was like, it totally revamped everything that I wanted from Nintendo. So it was like, it made it so I didn't even need the Nintendo anymore, since those are the games I liked best anyway. So it's definitely Super Nintendo for me, is kind of the pinnacle and the starting point and like the pinnacle for me, because it was just so much fun getting it when you're that age.
Yeah, definitely. That Mario All-Stars one, there was one version of that had Mario World on it as well. And that is just like the killer cart. Like, you don't need anything else. Like, and the bang for your buck, like Mario World plus three, you know, Nintendo ones, four, I guess, because it has lost levels.
Lost levels, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that one was killer. I remember playing that actually at your house. It must have been not that long after we had moved away to the Midwest, because I remember, you know, I was the same. We had the NES in our house. I remember my mom being the first one to realize you could run holding the A button with Mario. Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
You could run. So we're all just walking through the levels. And I remember beating Mario 1 in the back of when she was working at a title company, and she took us with her to work, and we beat it and started screaming and jumping up and down, and she came back and yelled at us for that. But so I definitely have memories of that, you know, console for sure. But you know, it was when Nana bought that Super Nintendo and had it in her house, and it only had one game as far as I remember. She only had Mario Kart. Maybe she had Mario World and Mario Kart. But man, that was a brilliant move by her if she wanted to, like, you know, block out the other grandparents and like vie for first place grandparent, like,
yeah and keep us occupied,
right?
That's true. That's true. Yeah, she could. yeah
you know what's funny, and you'll probably remember this too, is the most vivid memories I have of the original Nintendo system that we had is when we got the Super Nintendo. We kind of, you know, moved it to the side, didn't use it as much, but we had, my dad bought that conversion van, remember, the big tall van, and there was the TV in there, and it had like a little VCR in a socket, and you could play movies like for long road trips. Like, it was like this super, super cool thing. And we figured out that it had the same inputs as the Nintendo. So we moved the Nintendo in there. So we, you know, on a car ride, we'd, you know, play Contra or, you know, play some Mario on a car ride. And that's like where I remember playing Nintendo games, was in the car when it was kind of the second system, but it was such a funny thing to have in there.
It was, it sounds like such a cool setup for the 80s, but the thing about it is, like, one, the TV was way up high at the top of the van, so you had to kind of like crane your neck up to look at it. But two, like, the Nintendo was such a sensitive system where, you know, if you bump it, it stops reading the chips. And so, and that van was notorious for like bad suspension.
Yeah.
I mean, I think your dad broke the suspension by like intentionally hitting speed bumps really fast on it, so we'd kind of fly on it. But
yeah.
But yeah, definitely. That was a really cool setup. I remember that for sure. That was awesome. All right, Norton, what about for you?
So I'm not too much, I guess I'm not as far behind as I thought. So the game console that comes to my head is the N64. So I guess it's the predecessor to... Is that right?
No.
Super Nintendo? No.
The successor.
Successor. I was like, that doesn't sound right to me. And I don't know if you ever heard the story about how I got one, because at the time, our parents, you know, they didn't have a lot of money. But I, long story short, was at a friend's house, and we were playing... I think we were playing the original Smash Brothers that was on, I think it might have been like a launch title for that console. And someone got heated, forgot exactly what happened, but an antique ended up getting broken at this friend's house. And the reaction the mom had was to give his entire system with all of his games to me. And I just had this realization the other day that I still have it. I never gave it back to the guy, and I easily could have at any point in the rest of our friendship. And we kind of didn't become friends. You know, it faded off after that, and I wonder if he was holding a grudge. Anyway, it's a great system, and especially because of the weird third little dong that it has on that control, it just sticks in my mind. It's like such a unique time and space, you know, because I think they also – that was when they started to do the clear case games too, or, consoles, so you could see through into the controller or
– Oh, you have one of the skeleton types?
Yeah, exactly.
Like the blue skeleton plastic or whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my favorite era of design. Like, you know, the iMac. I think you guys, Evan, you and Maddie both had iMacs, I remember at that time.
Yeah, that kind of like they were the clear rant, you know, various colors you could choose for that backing part.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it.
And like, especially now that I work for like a, you know, electronics manufacturer, like having that kind of I don't know, courage to be like, hey, look at our PCBs, like let everybody see that the gully works of your machine is like really, that's a lot of confidence, I think, in your product. So
that's a good point. So yeah, the game, I obviously, Smash Brothers was a hit, still is, and obviously Ocarina of Time, like I don't know if you can take a console or choose a console that's more iconic, maybe in that way of the launch titles that it had. So I got a little bit lucky, maybe. I don't know.
I was actually just talking about Zelda and its role at Nintendo to my son, actually, because we were, you know, it's usually the launch title for a new system, and it's often typically the swan song for that system as well, like a Zelda game will be. And so you have, for example, something like Twilight Princess being the last game that was one of the last games released on the GameCube, and one of the first games to be released on the Wii. And then you had Breath of the Wild being one of the last to be released on the Wii U and the first one released on the, you know, on the Switch. And kind of what it does is, I think what Zelda's, the purpose that it serves is, first, it's an introductory where it's to the hardware, to all the other third-party developers, saying this is what you can do with this system. Oh, wow. And so it always incorporates all the new mechanics, right? Like even the DS Zeldas that are often so highly criticized, I really liked those, even though, but you're like controlling him with a stylus and you're using both screens a lot and the clamshell. And you remember that's the one where you have to like literally shut the case to like copy a map from one screen to the other.
That's right.
And like there's weird stuff like that that they'll do just to kind of show off the hardware, because nobody knows the hardware better than Nintendo. And then their second, whenever they release a second Zelda game for that console, it's always like, this is the maximum of what this system can do. And if you want to keep going on this series, you know, go to the next system. Because if you played Breath of the Wild on a Wii U, it's not nearly the same experience if you played it on a Switch.
It's bad. Know?
So I think it's really cool, like what that series kind of serves to do. I'm saying that as I'm in the middle of Skyward Sword, and as frustrating as that game is, like it is, it did really make use of the Wii controls even more so than Twilight Princess did. Like it's definitely
to a fault, Wii game. I would say, yeah.
Yeah, to a fault, yeah. But you know, like you have to like use the controller to like make shapes, and you have to, there's all these different swinging motions and stuff to,
you can only, you know, kill those plants like laterally or horizontally.
Yeah. Right.
It drove me nuts.
Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff like that, where it's like, it is very much made for the hardware that it's on. You know what I mean? So,
wow. I never thought about that before. That blew it wide open for me.
Yeah, I mean, even I think the very first one in Japan, you know, so in Japan they had the Famicom, but then they had the Famicom disk system, which we never had in the U.S., but you literally are putting disks in to save stuff on it, like, because they didn't have the ability to save on the first, you know, round of Famicom games. But when it came to the US, they had their own save, you know, files on the cartridges. But so I think that came out. I'm pretty sure that came out on the disk system first here. And I don't know if you have ever seen it, but the controls for the Famicom are really different from the ones for the original Nintendo. They have a little microphone in the middle.
Oh.
Yeah, and almost nobody ever used that, but Zelda did. They used it in the very first Zelda game. If you shout into the mic, those big-eared, like, rabbit-looking creatures, they get all shocked and they can't move.
That's so cool.
I think I had heard about that before, that there was a version where you had to shout into the controller.
Yeah. And you look like an idiot. You're like holding it. You know. There's definitely in the DS they have that too, right? You have to shout into the controller or whistle into it or something like that. Or I think you blow into
blow,
it.
Blow, yeah.
I think you blow. Yeah, I think you blow in it. But yeah. So that it's kind of a cool series in that regard. But all right. Well, yeah. I mean, for me, I would say I'm very much the same as you, Evan. It would probably be the Super Nintendo for me. If I heard the word Nintendo, I'd probably think of that. But honestly, the one that I put the most hours into, other than maybe, I mean, I love the Wii and I love the Switch. But for me, it was probably the Game Boy, because we took so many road trips across the country, with my mom being from the Midwest and my dad being from the West Coast. We would just drive almost every summer, or just be, you know, going and visiting family within California and stuff. And so there was always a lot of time on my Game Boy. So I think that's probably the one I played the most, to be honest.
Hmm.
I'm actually still tempted to buy an old one. You can pick them up at the old used game stores and stuff, but, you know, I don't think I'd play it that much if I had it, to be honest, but.
I went down that same road. There's a popular company that I think they're called DK Retro or DK Oldie.
But that stands for Donkey Kong, right?
Yeah. But they have, I think, just a GameCube game. Because I was like, let's see. I've never really, you know, I had one when I was growing up, but I don't know what I did with it. But just the game was something like $180. And then, you know, you could definitely scale down. If you didn't want a case, if you didn't want like a manual, you could go down to $90 for just the disc. And then the console itself was also that same kind of scale, where if you wanted a controller or if you wanted the power unit, it was like $300. And so there's definitely a market for it if you're willing to pay. But I don't know if I'm that hungry, you know, if I don't want to feed the nostalgia monster that badly.
Yeah, I mean, it ends up being, I'm pretty sure once you open it, you're like, yes, and then it wears off almost instantly. Like, But I was curious. So where did you fall off then? Like, because for me, that would have been it for me. Like, actually, probably the 64, our family didn't buy anything from that generation. So we didn't have a PlayStation or a 64 or a Saturn or anything. But I had a friend who had a Saturn, I had a friend who had a 64, and I guess I had a friend who had a PlayStation 2, but we didn't buy anything from there. And that's where I fell off gaming completely, just because it stopped appealing to me. It all went 3D. I wasn't interested in that. And it also went more one player, I think. Like, they started focusing on single player experiences. But GameCube is where I was completely off the map. I don't think I ever touched one, to be honest. And so, yeah, like, even to this day, I've never played Mario Sunshine. It's probably the only one I never played.
It's a good
I
one.
Did play Wind Waker, because Wind Waker is amazing, but but that's about it. So, what about you, Evan? Where did you fall off of video games?
Pretty similar. So I had an N64, and I really liked that. I remember playing. You know, we talked about playing GoldenEye and some of the Tony Hawk games and. Super Mario 64 and Mario Kart 64 were huge. And then I never got a GameCube. I never really, same thing. Like, it's kind of a mystery to me. If I think about a GameCube, I kind of remember Drew having one and really liking it and playing it. And like, I maybe tried to play him at stuff, and it was like, you know, he would beat us at the GameCube Mario 64, the GameCube Smash Bros. And that probably made me hate it more. Like, well, this isn't even legit. Like, he can't beat us at, you know, Mario Kart 64. That's like the real Mario Kart.
Yeah.
And then we did get a Wii. But I remember it being more like, it wasn't like when it was coming out, and it wasn't like, oh, this is like the thing we have to play. It was kind of like, I don't know if you guys remember, I'm sure you, Adam and Drew, you probably do remember, like when Wii came out, it was like so huge. Because it was just so different, and like everyone, like Wii Sports is probably one of the top selling games of all time because that console was just massive. So I remember getting that, and kind of we played it a bit during like the craze and played Wii Sports when those things, when it kind of was the hot thing to do, and then kind of tapered off with it and didn't really get into those games, and didn't play a whole lot after that. So that's where things kind of tapered off for me. But yeah, I totally missed GameCube entirely.
You had an Xbox though, right? At some point?
Evie? Yeah. Then I had an Xbox in like college, and that was kind of like the last system I owned. Okay. I'd play, you know, a couple things on that, but that was when it started to be, you know, more sporadic, and it wasn't like the, you know, it wasn't when we were younger and it's like the new, you know, when N64 was coming out, like we knew it was on the horizon, and like
the drop
there were rumors about it, and you knew when it was going to come, and it was like all this anticipation. And then after that, like for Xbox, it was like, well, you know, I'll wait 6 months and the prices will go down. There was no, it was just kind of like, oh, well, it's kind of the new thing, or, you know, oh, it can play DVDs too. So, you know,
that's right,
might as well get that because it doubles as a DVD player. It was like, that's right, it just wasn't that excitement that you have when you're young. And you don't have to be young. I mean, people are still excited about the newest things that come out. But for me, at least, you know, there were other interests that kind of took a hold more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, actually, now that you just mentioned that, I remember buying a PlayStation 2 specifically because it was about the same price as a DVD player and it could play DVDs. And I think on that, I only ever played like the Kingdom Hearts games, and then like Katamari Damacy, I think, was like that game. Yeah. I don't think I ever bought anything else for that. So,
yeah, I think I remember playing that game at your place in Campbell.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that game's pretty wild.
Yeah, so I love that game though. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, guys, so here's what I have for us today. It's not really all that much, but I feel like we haven't really reported our main mission recently, and so I kind of wanted to just go down and get us all on the same page to see where we are and, you know, what we've learned and kind of where we're going to go from here. So, you know, Evan, you created that doc that has all the names from, I think it was a list of all the people who were in the credits of Lethal Enforcers. And then also I added a few names from the, you know, Chicago Tribune article that I had found. And so that gave us a list of maybe 30 and 40 people that we could contact here from the company to try to figure out if it was true or not that somebody in-house had done it. And if you guys remember, I think we had it listed that there was a total of maybe 89 people or something like that working for the company at that time, including executives. So we felt like this was a pretty good chance to figure it out because we had about 40 names. But what I hadn't considered was the fact that we won't be able to contact a lot of these people for one reason or another. So anyway, here's the current state of things. If you look at the document, I have color coded everything. So anything that's in yellow means that I found these people, but I haven't been able to get a hold of them yet. And anything that's in green are people that one of us at least has spoken to. So obviously Steve Johnson, you know, Evan, you went to some pretty great lengths to get a hold of him. And so he was in charge of, I think, game graphics and stuff in the coin-op department. Is that right, Evan?
Yeah, and I think all graphics. I think he might have done like box art and cabinet art even. But yeah, he was in charge of graphics.
Okay. So Yeah, and so we've mentioned some of these other people before, people that I haven't actually been able to get a response from, but you know, we have Jay Korbecki, who was, you know, in I think parts and services, like you know, maintenance and stuff. Mike Gallo, who I have been able to speak to, and he's actually been really helpful. He's been giving me a lot of information, as much as he can remember. So, and then this next one on the list, I'm just kind of going down the list of in the order that they appear in the credits. So the person after that was Masa Aotani, and I found him. I've reached out on several different platforms, but haven't really got any response. So
I've reached out to him as well with no luck.
Okay. The next three names are people that I haven't found them, but I did get a hold of somebody who I want to be careful here. I know that up until this point, we've been kind of cavalier about just saying people's names on mic, and I don't know. I don't want to blow up everybody's spot and be like, oh, we spoke to this person and they told us about this person, because some of these people probably would prefer to remain private or with an alias or something. So I'm not going to say exactly who I spoke to and who told me what. But you know, these are the people who are listed in the credits. So I'm going to read their names as they're listed in the credits. And the same thing with the people who are quoted in the Chicago Tribune. I'm going to read their name as it was at that time, because this is all, you know, out there in the public. So these next three names, we have Christy H., J.P. Steele, and Kevin Booth. And I was actually able to get some information from a different employee that Christy H. was secretary for the president of Konami of America at that time. So, yeah, the person said she was a very, very blonde secretary. And when you look at the actual like credits, she does look like a very, you know, she does have very blonde hair anyway. So so it's unlikely that Christy H. would know what, you know, who was doing what, you know, because I think she was more of a kind of secretarial role for the president of the time. And the president at that time he's further down on the list. I added him later. Quite far towards the bottom, I guess. His name is Susumu Sakamoto, and so I actually found him on social media, but it, you know, obviously I haven't been able to connect to him or anything. And then J.P. Steele, I'm going to come back to this name, but J.P. Steele, we had determined that she was in the licensing department. She's credited in some other games as Judy Steele. And, I'll come back to that in just a moment. And skipping over the next one, I don't have anything for this next person, but, Norton, you tried to get a hold of this guy, Randy.
Yeah.
And I think you had a LinkedIn message blocked or banned or whatever, kind of dead on arrival, but, I think that the person that we found on Facebook who we thought was kind of, you know, extreme right wing kind of person, I think that was a different person. I think that the name is spelled wrong.
Huh.
So I haven't given up on this name. I think he worked at Midway after working at Konami. And so we may be able to get to him through our Midway connections. He was a marketing manager there. And so I don't know how much he would know, unless it was somebody in the marketing department who, you know, who did the voices.
Stepped in. But yeah.
Yeah. It's a possibility, but these next two, Woodman and DeSanto, these are both women. If you look in the credit scenes, it shows who they were in the game. And I found out that this person, Woodman, was an older woman who worked in the human resources department. So she actually might know something, just because she would have been aware of everybody in the company, you know, in some form or another. And then the person below that, DeSanto, was Woodman's assistant. So, but the person who gave me this information said that neither of them would, they either wouldn't talk or they wouldn't know. So, I haven't reached out to these people. I don't know even how to contact them. I haven't found anything that leads to anybody who could be them, to be honest. But yeah, but those people might know something just because HR would probably be the department that would know the most.
Think so, right?
Yeah. So below that, we have Lenkowski, and this person I was able to find and I tried to contact through Facebook and some other things, but was not able to make a connection with them yet. And then below that, Rich W. So Rich W. is Rich Wisniewski, and he's also credited in a couple other games, and he is, I think he was actually in accounting and finance at Konami. He was a senior VP of accounting and finance. And he actually went off to Bandai Namco and became the SFO there. But he is not there any longer. I think he might be retired. So this is a name that I think we could contact if we work at it. It's not exactly super accessible, but this is a name we could probably get at.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm going to skip down a little bit here. Down here where it gets to like Yamane, Matt, Sam Omi, Nobukaji, and Yoshi, all of these names here, These are all Japanese people. I'm pretty sure that – I'm not sure if Matt is or not, but nobody can actually put a definite finger on him. It could be Matt Chang, who worked in other Konami titles, but I'm not sure. But – definitely Sam Omi, Nobukaji, and Yoshi. These are all Japanese staff who were working there. And the fact that they put these in blocks the way that they did leads me to think that probably Matt was also Japanese staff. The reason I say that is if you look at like B. Woodman and C. DeSanto are put together and they were both in the same HR department. And then we get people like Kevin Booth and Rand Severin, who I think were both in marketing, so I think that there may have been something, there's something to that where they were putting them in that way. So Sam Omi was actually second in command in the Japanese like management team. His American name was Sam, but I don't know what his first name was in Japanese. And then Nobukaji was a younger guy there who was in training to become management. So, these guys are all kind of the, you know, the Japanese like top brass that were there at the company. And then of course Yoshi is our guy, Yoshi Hatano, who was the director and programmer for this game. Sadly, so I'm going to actually skip further down. So I did get a hold of somebody who was able to tell me just more about the general structure of the company. Like, you know, this guy's the president. This person did this. This person, you know, they kind of gave me like the like corporate structure of what was going on at Konami, right? And in the consumer side, basically, the video games had two sides: the consumer side and the coin-op side, so arcades and home consoles. And the top of the kind of development team for the home console division was a guy named Emil Heidekamp, I think is his name. He's down here in the list somewhere. Yeah, Emil Heidekamp. And I actually was able to get a hold of him and talk to him. And, you know, I said, I know that console and coin-op were really, you know, completely separate, but what do you know about the, you know, coin-op kind of stuff? And he said, you know, the most important, like the chief kind of executives working over there in the coin-op department were Steve K and Frank P, who are listed here right after our Japanese staff are, right? We have Steve K and Frank P. But unfortunately, both of them have passed away. So, Frank Pellegrini, we already saw that. I think he passed away from COVID. And then Steve Kaufman, I actually found an announcement of him when he passed away as well. So the two people who would be the most likely to know what was going on in the coin op department, which was, you know, Steve K, the head of development, and Frank P, the head of sales for CoinOp. Those two are both, unfortunately, gone. And then below that, Kei Hiraoka, who was also the head of foreign sales from the Japanese office. And he was the guy who did all these contracts and picked up these properties and stuff. He's also passed away. So our three main guys who would have known everything about the game are, you know, unfortunately, you know, passed away. So that's very unfortunate. And also Mike Kubin, if we see underneath that, he was also, I think, involved in the CoinUp division, but he has also passed. The other people who I've contacted here, you know, we have Mary H, who we saw from a previous article. She was the one who was talking about Dance Dance Revolution.
Oh, right.
In a different newspaper article. And Jun Narita, who we have here. These people also, you know, I found them, but I can't get any response from them. So, you know, and then just moving down that list, we have George Limones, who I did speak to, and David Ueda, who I did not speak to. So that's it for those credits. Honestly, it's really disappointing because, as you can see, out of what, 10 or 15 names, four or five of them have already passed away. There's some people who are impossible to get a hold of, and then there's some people who we just don't even know who they are. So it's a little bit disappointing in that regard.
Yeah, that's tough. I wonder too if, like, you know, because you're talking about Christy H, I think, was the one who was the secretary, right? And it's like her little sprite was one of the ones who was a hostage, and, you know, one of the voices we're potentially looking for is that kind of like female hostage voice. So it could be something like that, where, like, she, you know, they brought in, you know, we need a female in distress, you know, and they brought in one of the secretaries to do it. And it's like, it's going to be hard to find, you know. That's kind of a hard, just having the name Christy H is so tough. And, you know, that could somehow be the person we're looking for. And not many people really even know that she did it. You know, they just kind of brought in someone who was in the office that had a female voice. It's just so tough.
Yeah. You know what? That's an interesting idea, though, that might be worth pursuing, just because she would have been the quickest person to call. If, you know, I'm just imagining the situation where the Japanese developers have created this game. They call over to the American staff and say, hey, do you have somebody to fill in for this? And of course, the person they're calling is the head of the Konami of America, probably, right? And so he says, okay, and he just reaches out to his secretary. Whether she's the one who he wants for the part or not, he's going to say, hey, find some people to do this, right? Probably to her. So,
yeah.
That is a possibility. And I do know some. So I have spoken to somebody at Konami who does know who she was. I don't know if she was close to her or not, but I'll reach out there again and just see if I can find more information about Christy H, because that might be one worth checking out. I mean, I think all of these women their sprites were hostage people.
Yeah.
So I do want to go after her, and I want to go after JP Steele as well, and there's a reason for that. So if you remember, so I'm skipping over to the Chicago Tribune article. There was somebody there named Kathy McCarthy, and she was in charge of licensing back in 1993. So I did get a hold of her, and, you know, she has since changed her name. She's been, you know, now that she's married and she's, you know, moved out of state, I think. But so she was like, you know, I think maybe a little bit weirded out by me finding her. But she's like, I'm surprised you found me, but good sleuthing. And so she's been really cool. You know, she said she didn't work on the game because she came in 1993, and that game came out in 92. So it was before her time, but she said she would check with people, who she remembered from the company. And to her credit, she actually did. Like, she got back to me a few days later and she's like, oh, it looks like you've been talking to some other people that I knew. So, but yeah, she mentioned that the person who had the job before her was JP Steele. And so this person, JP Steele, would likely have been the person who, you know, talked to licensing people at Marvel. That's my guess. You know, I don't think that that's a, you know, I don't think that that was a very big department, to be honest, most likely. So, so she might be somebody to kind of get a hold of and just see. And I'll just tell you what Kathy told me. So here's what she said. In general, when dealing with any licensed game, we would go through the whole game with the licensor for review and approval at every step of the way. So, and this was, you know, she worked on the games like Animaniacs, NBA, and NBA, NFL, things like that. And so she, you know, she feels like it's probably likely that, you know, they would have been checking in all the time. So if that's the case, whether they did these in-house or had them, you know, recorded somewhere, I feel like Judy Steele would have been the contact to say, hey, listen to these files. Are they okay with you? Right.
Right.
So, there is a possibility. Maybe she knows something. So she's probably the person that we might want to contact as well. So I was actually, I had a lot more luck with the people who were in this Chicago Tribune article. I actually got a hold of most of them. Except for one, actually. And even him, I found him. He's very, very accessible as far as, like, I can find him on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I found his, you know, home phone address and I mean, home phone and everything like that. So I'm fairly sure that we could get a hold of him if we want to go the whole, you know, Steve Johnson route. But I don't know if it's worth it. But everybody else I was able to contact, and they've all been really, really friendly and accommodating, right? So the people mentioned in that article was, you know, Michael Blaustein, Christian Munoz, Marlies Cohen, and Kathy McCarthy. And then they mentioned Susumu Sakamoto, who was the president at the time. But I haven't spoken to him. But everybody else, basically, I've spoken to. So, yeah, they were all really helpful. They gave me lots of information about who was doing what and things like that. So, if you look at the very bottom of the list, then I added a few names that are just names that came up in conversation. So these are not people who are in credits anywhere. They're not in any of the game credits, and they're not in any newspaper articles, but there's just some names that people threw out to me. So that's how I found Emil Heidekamp. And these other people, you know, I found some of them. I've been trying to reach out and see, but they aren't people who are who we can necessarily connect to any one particular project. So okay. I don't know what they're going to result in, but that is where we are currently. Now here's what I want to say about this all. We are operating under two possible scenarios here, right? There's the scenario that this was all recorded in house, and there's the scenario that this was done by a, you know, professional voice actor. We have at least one person on record saying that he remembers it being a voice actor. And we have another person here that we spoke to that said that they did occasionally use them. And he, you know, told us about SVI and other things like that. And we confirmed that SVI had worked with Konami. So that's one theory. The other one is obviously that it was all done in-house. And so talking to this person who was in licensing, talking to Kathy McCarthy, you know, she's basically saying that they would have been checking with the licensor at every step. So that makes me, it just kind of leads me to believe that they would have done things the more professional route with such a big licensed property, especially as that's what they had done with, you know, Ninja Turtles and Simpsons and other games like that that came out around the same time, is they were careful to get the right, you know, to get the right voices. So I just feel like it's very unlikely for a licensed property that they would have been doing it in-house. So that, to me, I'm much more leaning in that direction. I'm like 70%, maybe 80% in the camp that they would have recorded it outside of the company.
Hmm.
So the only problem that leads is, why do we think that some of these voices are the same between this and Lethal Enforcers? So,
yeah. Right. Because, I could also see it being like somewhat of a mix, especially the female hostage voice in Lethal Enforcers that we think is pretty close to, or I'm pretty sure is the same as Kitty Pryde in the X-Men mm-hmm. game. And Kitty Pryde really only has one line it's pretty minor. And if that was one, I could easily see that being a voice where it's like, hey, we've recorded, we got these actors in, we recorded the big parts. And then it's like, oh, well, you know, Kitty has this, we have Kitty and there's like a, you know, we could put a speech bubble, her saying, you know, help me or save me. Or I think she says something about saving the professor. Like, oh, do you want to choose a speech bubble? It's like, well, no, like that's not going to look great. Let's just get someone to record that line quickly. You know, so I could see like a line like that. But the other voices that we think are the same are like the main narrator voice and Magneto. Yeah. And I just don't see voices that important. You know, unless like somehow Marvel gives you total control. It's like, yeah, we don't care about the voices at all. And so you do them in house. Yeah. If they're overseeing it all, like those seem like the voices they would care most about. So it's weird that those two voices in particular are the ones we think are the same, when you would think those would be the ones that Marvel's most protective on.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, the overall narrator, I think that could be anybody because it's not a character.
True.
And like you said, yeah, Kitty Pryde is an NPC. And I mean, yeah, but the Magneto one is, you know, that's the big question. So,
yeah. And the Magneto one is one, again, it's like Kitty Pryde. It sounds so close. It sounds so similar to that Die Pig's Lethal Enforcer's voice. I cannot imagine those being different people. And it somehow is a coincidence. Mm-hmm. They're both Konami games.
Well, I guess there's also the hybrid possibility that, like you just said, some of this was done professionally and some of it was done in-house. You know, that there's definitely room for that. Yeah. To be the case. So,
and I agree with you. I think if it wasn't all professionally voice recorded, I think some of it had to be, because I think we mentioned this on another episode, but I mean, we had Susan Silo unsure if the White Queen voice from the video game was her. And so how, what are the odds of getting in just a random Konami employee that can mimic a voice so well that the voice actor who did the TV voice is like, well, that right. could be me. You know, even all these years later, I can't imagine someone being that good, that you just happen to have on staff.
Right. Right. Well, so I don't know, in the case that this was done by professional, you know, people, I don't know where we can go from here on that angle. I have already spoken to the, you know, talent kind of group that worked with Konami and the studios that they've worked with. And, you know, everybody's just said that there are no records and nobody around who remembers it. So that it feels like a dead end to me in that regard. That's why I was kind of hoping that it was in-house, because we at least have some names to go for there. But
yeah,
I guess the only other thing is if, you know, there's like two or three little cards left that I feel like we have. One is if we ever can get a hold of the actual sound designer, you know, Fugami Seiichi, he might remember. The other kind of, you know, life rafts that we have is if we find somebody who did one of those voices, they might be able to lead us to all the others.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, ultimately that's our real hope in all of this, right? Because we haven't talked about the voice of Colossus in so long, because we don't, you know, it's barely a voice. And so we're just kind of hoping we can somehow stumble our way into one of these other voices. And then they also know something about the Colossus voice.
Right.
So there's like this level of obscurity we've kind of been ignoring a little bit too, of like, we could very well find Magneto and he's like, well, I don't know, that did that Colossus thing. Doesn't even sound like anything.
Yeah, that's very true. God, how frustrating would that be if we find all the other voices and we don't find that one? They're like, yeah, I did the narration and I did Magneto and I did the Blob and Pyro, but I don't know who did Colossus.
Heartbreaking. It would be, I think we've been away from it for so long that I would just be happy to find anyone who did a voice at this point. But
but
I know what you mean. It would be, it also feels like the kind of thing where the scenarios we were hoping for of like, okay, if we can get in touch with the sound guy and the director, then they can lead us, like this kind of linear path. seems like it's completely gone. And it's going to, the thing that, if we ever get there, the thing that's going to open it up is going to be like, you know, we talk to this HR person, or we talk to Secretary Christy H, and they're not like, oh, I know who did that. It's like, oh, that's me. Like, oh, I didn't know anyone knew I did that. You know, it's like, we're going to have to stumble upon someone who did it and no one really knows about it. I think, I don't know if we're ever going to find someone who like has all the information. It's going to be someone, it's going to be so, so much of a random occurrence if we ever do. That's where my head's kind of at. I feel like I'm still hopeful we can crack it, but it's going to be in an unexpected place maybe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, I think, so the next step, I'm just trying to plan our next step here. And so the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to take over these names. So Christy H, JP Steele. These two names, I think, have some potential. And so, you know, I don't know. I feel like I might be able to find something there. So I'm going to highlight those in magenta. These will be my tasks. And Drew, these two people here, we have a lot of information on them. Lenkowski and Rich W. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of potential ways to reach out to them. So can I give these names to you and see if you can try to get a hold of them? It doesn't need any calls. Just,
well, as you promised, they're not dead leads.
I can't promise anything, man. I can't promise anything at all. I just, yeah.
No.
Well, I mean, why don't you guys each take one of those? Because, each of you take one of those, because I think, you know, I think that they're not super hard to find. And then the other one would be this one, Kevin O'Donohue down here, who was mentioned in the Tribune article. We found several ways to get a hold of him, but haven't actually reached out. I mean, haven't actually got a hold of him. So maybe somebody can try that one as well.
Yeah. Well, I'll take Lenkowski and Rich W. Since I don't have Instagram, okay. And I think we do have an Instagram for Kevin. So maybe Drew, maybe you can take Kevin.
Okay.
And since Instagram's one of the possibilities.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good that we're getting back there, because it's, you know, I was kind of gung-ho right away, and things, you know, you get busy, things slow down. I think we've all slowed down on this a little bit. Adam, I think you're still kind of working, but probably not at the same pace. Actually, maybe Brandon is the only one who's still working just as hard as he was months ago.
Yeah, that's probably, I can bet on that. Yeah, that, I'm pretty sure.
Brandon's effort level hasn't changed, but I know mine is has died off. So it'll be good to have another task, and you know, it's
good.
Maybe it's like fishing, where you get a little bored, but then you get that nibble, and it gets you. Gets the adrenaline going again, and then you're kind of fired up to try to hook that fish.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, any of these names here at the bottom too, Drew, if you want, you can go after them. Not necessary, but you know, we have these like Steve Jackson, who was the VP of sales. You know, Bob Blau, Darren Decotois. I think all three of these people are in sales, and I'm almost positive that Darren Decotois was in coin op sales, from what I've heard. So he might be somebody to go after, although I have heard from some people that he may have passed away, but I'm not sure. So if you want to go after that one, that might be worthwhile as well. Now, the other thing I was thinking is, Evan, I don't know how much you want to go back to Steve Johnson, but if he was in CoinOp, he might just know. It might be worth kind of digging around a little bit more just to see what he remembers. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
If it's just something like, do you remember any other people who were in CoinUp that we could talk to or something like that? But
yeah, I can try these first two, and then if anything comes up, or maybe we can all touch base, and if anything comes up in our conversations, maybe we can make a little list of things that maybe we want to run by Steve Johnson, and then I can muster up the courage to track him down again.
Yeah. Well, I have his Facebook now, so you could probably try that method instead. I don't know.
But, oh, that's right. Yeah, that's a good alternative.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you want to call his personal phone again. But, So, okay, so that's where we are with this one. And then also the last thing I want to say before we wrap up is just that we now have a deadline on this, more or less, because we're going to recreate. This is kind of a way of capping this season and season one. We're going to recreate the road trip that we took, which was prominently spoken about on season one, from California to Iowa, and we're going to go beyond that and go to Chicago and visit the Galloping Ghost Arcade, where we can play Trog, both versions, the original and the, you know, eventual commercial release. And I have set up an appointment for us to hang out with George Petro from Midway, who made that game.
Oh, let's go. That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's going to be a good road trip. We're going to drive and visit the old pizza place, see if we can talk to Harold Person Man or whatever the hell his name is. You know, and anybody who we've been kind of contacting along the way, we're going to try to get a hold of those people and see, you know, and just kind of go over all that stuff, because I think it's a nice kind of, you know, coup de grace or something for this. I don't know if that's the right word for this, but kind of way to wrap it up. So,
well, and you know, that actually gets me thinking, maybe the most appropriate way to contact Steve Johnson, instead of going back to Facebook, I mean, I have his address, maybe we just show up at his house. It's like the only way we could intrude in his life more would be to show up uninvited at his doorstep. So maybe that's
with like sleeping bags under our arms.
Maybe that's the finale of this all.
Yeah. So Steve, where do we camp out?
Yeah. Your brother and sister said no, so you're really our last option.
Oh my goodness.
Oh man. Yeah, I sometimes wonder, like, when, you know, when I'm talking to somebody, every once in a while the conversation will just drop dead. Like, there's a couple people like that where I've talked to them, they're like, you know, oh yeah, great, we're kind of chatting and stuff, and all of a sudden it just goes cold. And I wonder in those cases, like, have they talked to Steve or somebody like that, where like we've personally invaded their life? Yeah, but I do feel bad about that poor guy. But I'm glad that he was cool about it. So,
yeah, exactly.
All right, guys. Well, that is what we have for now. And everybody who is listening at home, please remember to like and subscribe. And actually, let me make it even more specific. If you would, go on to iTunes, because that is the one that matters. All the rest of them don't really matter nearly as much. If you go onto iTunes and just click like or make a comment about our show, that's the one that, you know, it tweaks the whole algorithm and the RSS feeds and everything like that. So everybody will get a lot more listeners and ears on this case if you can go and do that. If you like the show, just go to iTunes and make a quick comment or rate our show. It would really help us out. And beyond that, please follow us on Instagram, where we are at Searching for Grog. And please tell friends about this show, because we're not obviously doing it for money. We're obviously not doing it for anything other than just the fact that it's kind of a fun challenge for us and it's a good chance for us to hang out. But the response that we've had from people has been really encouraging, and so we would love to have more of that. So if you are into the show, then please tell people to listen to it, even though I understand that it is a very difficult show to explain to your friends. I have heard people say that. They're like, you know, they're like, I don't know how to get people to like pay attention when I say that, because your show does not fit in any category. It's like, oh, it's about guys who are trying to, you know, piece back old memories about video games. And by the way, doing this. And it's like, yeah, man, if you think you're having a hard time explaining it, like, imagine being me trying to contact old employees and explain what whiz we're doing. So
right. How you got their number.
Yeah. So, but, yeah, we will never back down. We will always be a very impossible to categorize podcast. And, even in future seasons, I think we'll continue in that vein. So, all right. Well, guys, it has been a fun time chatting about this and Zelda and everything else. And I hope you guys have a wonderful day.
You too. See you next time.
Yeah, until next time.
You've been listening to Searching for Grog, a podcast about fuzzy memories, family mysteries, and the video games that tie them all together. Special thanks for this episode go out to Mike Gallo, Christian Munoz, Marlies Cohen, Kathy McCarthy, Emil Heidekamp, and all the other fine folks at Konami of America who were generous with their time and answering our questions. Our music is by Captive Portal. This episode, and everything that we do, is dedicated to the memory of our Nana, Barbara Belangi, and our cousin, Alyssa Gunn Maldonado.